This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
I feel remiss because I let you say database the whole show. That's not how you say that word.
How do you say that word?
It's database.
It can be either way. No. Tomato, tomato.
Nobody says tomato either.
My brother said tomato.
Okay, well, now we know, you know. It's a familial thing then, I guess.
He also said, well, I don't say tomato, I say tomato. He also said aunt.
I don't know how I feel about aunt and aunt. It feels weird to call somebody your aunt, because, like, do you have a pet aunt? I don't understand. But it feels really snobby to say your pet aunt. Your pet aunt. No.
Yes, that does feel snobby.
I think that's the beginning of the show. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. What have you been working on lately?
Rails. We kind of wrapped up all of the remaining blockers for RC1 of Rails 5. I think there might be one or two left that the people who they're assigned to are unresponsive, so I might just go clean those up. So hopefully by the time this airs, RC1 will have shipped. There were a couple of issues that just ended up taking longer to figure out than I would have liked, so we ended up pushing back. But now it's finally time, and so if all goes well, we'll probably ship the final release on the 15th.
The final RC release on the 15th?
No, Rails 5.
Ooh. The 15th of March? The Ides of March?
Yes.
Beware the Ides of March.
Because we do two-week RCs.
Okay. Have people been using the beta? How can you tell? I guess you can tell by number of downloads on RubyGems, maybe, loosely?
Yeah, but that's always such a terrible metric.
Mm-hmm.
Even for release gems, I think that number of downloads is a terrible metric for popularity, because it's not even necessarily how many users you have, it's how much your users use CI.
Right. Or how many developers you have of each. Yeah. Like what's your bundling pattern? What's your bundle hygiene like?
Number of issues is the best metric, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If you accept that there is no software without bugs.
That makes sense.
Like, it's also possible that there's some incredibly popular thing that's used by everybody that is perfectly documented, nobody's ever confused by it, and it has no bugs, and that project would have a false negative on issue count. But so, yeah, anyway, to answer your actual question, yes, people have been using the beta. We ended up with a little under 100 issues that were on the Rails 5 milestone. Those weren't all necessarily from the beta. There were also a smattering of things that have just been there throughout the cycle that we wanted to finish before we ship the release. I guess we can actually go look at the number of closed things on the milestone, can't we? 388 issues closed on the milestone.
That's pretty good. And those issues don't get assigned to the milestone until after like beta 1 or something like that? Is that what happens?
No, that's what I mean, is that a lot of those may have been around from before the beta was released. Like, these aren't necessarily all things that came out of the beta. Like, if you go to the last page, there's an issue on it that was opened in 2011.
Oh, and filed onto Rails 5 in 2011. Yeah. It was like, yeah, we'll get to this in, like, I don't know, Rails 5. Sure. Throw it on there. Yeah, I mean, this is the first time I've actually, I mean, I've downloaded the betas before and tried to, like, I don't know, let me see how this app does on the betas. And it's always a bigger pain in the butt, which maybe we can circle back around to use the beta than I want it to be. But this time, I wanted to get ahead of having clearance support Rails 5. So I've been doing it via that and was able to file, I don't know, two releases. There are two issues, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like two issues against it. Like, one I found was like that some changes were made to when valid gets kicked off, or when
you're talking about the change where validation, where a few of the validations only were applied when the record was changed.
Right. So like I had an issue opened where like on clearance, password is a virtual field. Or a virtual attribute, or you know, whatever, transient attribute, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't get persisted to the database because we persist this encrypted password instead. But we need to validate the password field to make sure it's actually present. And yep. So if you didn't change anything else in the model that was connected to the database, it wouldn't know that it needed to run validations. It would just say, you didn't change anything. So there's nothing here to validate. So, you know, yeah, it's valid. But then when you went to go save, it would fail because it wasn't valid. So it was really kind of a confusing thing. And, you know, once we figured out what the issue was, Eileen jumped on it and worked it out. But I looked at where it was and I was like, nope, I'm not going to be of any help here.
Yeah. No, and it was interesting because, right, I put her on that issue just because she was the author of the commit that introduced that bug in the first place. And we didn't intentionally, like, there was no intention, even though it would make sense just to not run validations on fields that aren't changed. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the purpose of this change. It was a side effect of trying to fix another bug, and this wasn't applied to all validations. It was specifically, like, the presence validation and one other.
Okay. Yeah, so I was excited to see that one get worked out. I've had a couple other things where I ended up having to like point clearance at Rails master while these bugs were getting fixed or something like that, but it wasn't too bad. The one that is not going to be fixable is there's a change in Rails 5 when you're doing integration tests or controller tests, which I guess are now the same thing mostly.
They're still separate, but we're trying to implement controller tests in terms of integration tests under the hood.
Is that going to happen? Is that because you say trying to?
I'm not sure if that was finished or not in time for Rails 5.
Okay. Anyway, one of the changes that was made was the methods that you would use, like get, post, delete, things like that, to simulate HTTP requests in your controller specs or to actually make HTTP requests in your integration tests, were changed to no longer take positional arguments, but instead take keyword arguments, which is a pretty good change because passing like two hashes that were totally unnamed for your, like, if you wanted to pass session variables and parameters or something like that, was pretty clumsy. Like, you'd look at it and be like, you just have to know what those hashes are, right? Unfortunately, if you are in a situation like I am, where you have to support multiple versions of Rails, or if you're, you know, you just happen to have some controller tests that flex this behavior some, if one of the keys you're passing happens to be one of the, like, as a parameter, happens to be one of the keyword, has to share a name with the keyword argument, then you're going to get odd, really odd behavior. Things aren't going to work. And you're not even going to get a chance to see the deprecation that tells you that, you know, this behavior has changed, because it'll just, like in my case, I was using the keyword session. A clearance form is passing parameters about a session in like the login form. Mm-hmm. And that was getting read as the session keyword argument, which is obviously not a parameter. So the params were coming through to the controller as blank, which was kind of maddening for a little while until I figured out what was going on. So I was like, I'm not even getting that deprecation here. So, like, it's not that. You know?
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, wait, I'm not getting that deprecation. I should be getting that deprecation.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of those you, of course, already knew about that change. But that's also for people who wouldn't necessarily have already known about that before going into it. That's one of the reasons we deprecate things, but you should also still check the change log and not just rely on deprecation warnings to actually catch every change, because there are situations like that where maybe the deprecation warning is flawed in some way, or there's some case that we couldn't catch, or that it wasn't performant to catch. Those are always the worst, when there's something where you want to change some behavior and you know that it wouldn't be a huge impact change, but issuing a deprecation warning would be a massive performance hit in some hot path, and there's no other way to deprecate it.
Right.
There have been a couple of cases that's just happened in the last release.
Yeah, so once I got that figured out, unfortunately, because I'm working on a library that needs to support older versions of Rails, and it's unfortunate, particularly in this case, because even 4.2 doesn't support the keyword arguments here, or even like passing a hash as a hash of options. It's unfortunate that I kind of had to work around that in clearance. And the way I worked around it in clearance was basically to go back to positional argument, like have clearance have a shim inside of it that maps the keyword arguments back to positional arguments, or I can't remember exactly which way. It must do the other way. So in my tests, I use positional arguments, and then I map them to keyword arguments myself rather than letting Rails do it. Because I know I'm never passing those, you know, keys in from my tests.
Right.
So it works out okay for me. It's unfortunate that even after Rails 5 ships and I bump support for clearance to 4.2 plus, I'm still going to have this workaround. One of the things I proposed was like having a gem that would be supported for 4.2 through 5.1, basically through 5.1, that would let you use the old form. But I understand why that doesn't want to, why nobody wants to do that, because nobody wants to support such a thing, and it's kind of a corner case, right? So, oh well.
I have thought about doing like a Rails future gem that basically just backports deprecations or breaking changes to earlier versions.
That would be interesting. That'd be really interesting. I'm thinking about this. This is probably a bad idea for libraries, but wouldn't it be interesting if you could say, this library supports Rails 5, and then say, if you want to use it with 4.2, use Rails Future.
Right.
Right. And have like kind of an optional dependency. Basically, you need, it's a required dependency if you're on 4.2. I don't think there's no way that Bundler or Ruby Gems can map this, but like plenty of gems have this thing where like if you want to use my gem, you also have to depend on one of these other gems or something like that.
Yeah, no, I really wish Ruby Gems had some notion of optional dependencies. Like not even necessarily for that kind of complexity, but even just saying like Rails optionally depends on the PG gem. And if you are using Rails with PG, here's the version requirement. We can't even express that.
True. I mean, I guess you could do that at runtime.
We do it at runtime.
Okay. So you say, like, if PG is loaded, basically, then check its version and...
Nope. We call gem PG at the top of the PostgreSQL adapter.
Okay. And then it check its version and say, if it's a version we don't support, then error.
Well, no. Gem takes the version as an argument.
So if Rails loads the PG adapter, it will blow up. It would blow up, or it would refuse to load the PG adapter at all.
Ruby gems would blow up when we called gem if there was another call to, if something else had also tried to declare a dependency on PG with a version that didn't match up.
Interesting.
It'd be a version mismatch error or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. And so far, like, so once that was out of the way, those were the two biggest changes I think I had to deal with. Everything else was fine. Like I had to eliminate some deprecations. Like I had tests that use render text, which is no longer a thing in Rails 5. So that was kind of a hassle because I need like the replacement for it is not, again, one of those things, the replacement for it is not in Rails 4.2 or in Rails 3.0 or whatever, all the versions I support. So I kind of have to shim that. But
we just renamed it to plain, right?
I think so. Let me look at the commit here.
Because I vaguely remember it. There was some confusion between when it would fall back to a default and whether or not it was rendering plain text. And render text was usually doing the wrong thing. So we renamed it to render plain, which always sets the MIME type to text plain, whereas render text would not necessarily do that. But I don't remember exactly what it did before.
I think I'm looking at the change I did in clearance, and I think clearance was kind of taking advantage of the fact that it wasn't rendering plain text. It was rendering HTML because I replaced the calls of render text with render HTML.
Render HTML is in 4.2, isn't it?
I don't think so. I don't know. I have if Rails version major greater than or equal to 5, render HTML, else render text.
Okay.
Maybe we'll have to look at that. I don't know. Maybe I did that unnecessarily because I was trying to bang out a bunch of deprecation warnings. Other things were like in generators, like used to be able to call, well, I guess in anywhere, but in the clearance generators, I call table exist to check if a certain table exists. But that's kind of a misnomer because we also need to check like views and anything else that Rails knows about that might be have a conflicting name. So they want you to use data source exist, which is just a better name. I think the behavior is the same as of Rails 5, but you should use data source exist. The biggest one that I hated doing was before action. And you last episode, you were like kind of unsure if before filter was going to stick around. Do you have any idea?
I'm fairly. Let me just double check right now because I can look at the code. I'm just trying to figure out where the hell the aliases are even defined because it is using some crazy meta programming.
Yep, because it's like it's probably saying like it probably has two arrays of like before.
Yep.
And then the suffix and possibly skip before and skip after.
Exactly. So now I'm trying underscore filter and seeing if that works.
Yeah, I did the same dance the other day and I couldn't find it. So I was like, I don't feel like testing it right now to see if it's there.
No, the deprecation is still there saying it will be removed in 5.1.
Okay, well then, so my code sticks around where I have like if responds to before action, then go ahead and call before action. Otherwise, call before filter. I thought about like shimming my own like clearance before action. I was like, it's a terrible idea. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So I just have the conditional.
That was the other thing I was going to say earlier. That's one of the reasons I was shying away from a Rails future gem is because I have this feeling that even though I would like to have more faith in humanity, gems are probably just going to depend on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that would be terrible because it will include breaking changes to Rails.
Mm-hmm. Like I liked what we did on T1D when we were going through the Rails 3.2 to 4.0 upgrade, where we knew we kind of identified the features we knew we were going to want to use from Rails 4, and we wrote them ourselves.
Yeah,
like we knew we wanted to use findBy, so we just wrote findBy and included that as a module everywhere. or on Active Record. And then we could use FindBy wherever we wanted. When we upgraded to Rails 4, we could pull out that module. We did the same thing for like Active Model Model and a couple other things, I remember. But
well, and some of them, right, like Strong Parameters was fine just because that started its life as a gem.
Right. That was super useful because if that just got sprung on you at Rails 4 and you had no time to prepare, like it was going to delay the upgrade to Rails 4. And it did. There's several clients we've worked with that are just on 3-something because they don't want to tackle the upgrade.
Well, you don't have to tackle strong parameters until 5, because that's like Shopify. That's our main blocker right now for our Rails 5 upgrade is getting rid of all of the remaining calls to add or accessible.
You do have to add. You would just have to add if you wanted to run Rails 4 with add or accessible. You would just have to add the gem, right?
Right, and if you wanted to move your code slowly, there's a migration. You can set the sanitizer on Active Record, and if you set it to migration, then that will be this middle ground where it uses both protected attributes and strong parameters. And basically, just if you pass in something that has gone through strong parameters, it won't apply protected attributes. But if you just pass a params hash that hasn't been permitted, then it'll go through
the add or accessible stuff, whatever that is.
Protected whatever it's called.
Right. Yeah. And I think we use that. Trevor did some work on a client project that I was on where he was the one who unfortunately had to go through all of the controllers and models and handle all this. And it's not a fun change to do, which is why I think, like, even though people know or people may know that they can just add protected attributes and get the behavior they had in Rails 3 in Rails 4, it's also an acknowledgement that, like, someday they're going to need to change this.
Right. Unless somebody else wants to take over protected attributes and keep it up to date.
Nope. As much as strong what are your feelings on strong parameters?
It does not go far enough, but it is objectively better than protected attributes.
It is better than protected attributes, but it's one of those things that I have difficulty remembering how to use in any case that's not simple. Where
such as
you want to permit a child, right? So you have an array of children. How do you do that? What's the syntax, right? And like the mnemonic I was basically given was like to permit an array, use a hash, to permit a hash, use an array. And that sort of works out. Like you want to give it an array of keys. If you're permitting a hash, you want to give it, it's kind of crazy.
Well, no, I mean, when you want to allow an array of something, then you have the key be the name of the field that you want and the value be an array. And then if it's an array of hashes, then you have all of the key names inside of that array. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting is it's actually really similar to the API for includes.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's true. And I don't have a problem with includes. Like when you start to nest them, it's just hard. It becomes hard to see.
Right.
But beyond like writing it, I don't generally have a problem. But for whatever reason, strong parameters with like accepts nested attributes for takes like 3 or 4 tries for me to be like, oh, okay, there it is. I got it.
What if you didn't use accept nested attributes for?
Sure, that would be fantastic. But there are times, as much as we hate on the accept nested attributes for, and I hate on it all the time, there are times when you're just like, oh, am I going to write a form object for this? Or am I just going to use accept nested attributes for?
Yeah.
Maybe nobody will notice. I'll just use accept nested attributes for. Does that mean I have to stop complaining about accept nested attributes for? Probably. Am I going to? No.
But what I'd like to see, where I'd like to see it eventually go is something that's a larger API, first of all, and not a single method, which would make cases like the one that you just described much clearer because there would be individual methods that you would call for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd also like to see typecasting, not all of typecasting, but a significant portion of typecasting moved into that layer and out of Active Record.
Right. So Active Record would get parameters that were already of the proper type.
Right.
And handle that. That would be interesting for, like, how would you handle using it in a non-controller context at that point?
It's meant to be used in a controller context. Like,
no, but how would you, if you want to use Active Record in a non-controller context, I guess you just initialize a parameters object with whatever you wanted and pass that in?
Well, if you're using it, if you're not accepting user input, then you presumably have values of the correct type already.
Sometimes they're difficult to construct, right? Particularly if you're using something like the attributes API, you could have some stuff in there that, like, this field very much you would expect to be a string, but it has some additional logic tied to it that does something, right?
Sure, and that's why I'm saying, like, move a lot of the type coercion. I mean, we can basically never actually get rid of type coercion from Active Record entirely, as much as I would like to do that. But we can do things like, you can no longer pass a string to an array field.
Mm-hmm. Types, man. Strong types.
Yeah.
Well.
but it's also then for JSON APIs, you can handle all of your validations at that level and return a 422 before we even hit user code.
Perfect. Yeah.
And you'd be able to generate JSON schema from that information automatically.
That sounds good.
Like, that's what I think needs to live at the controller level for parameter sanitizing, is something that has enough information that it could generate JSON schema if it wanted to.
All right. JSON schema?
Yeah.
Awesome. That would be perfect. Not JSON API.
Well, there are different things. Like, right, JSON schema just states, right, is just documentation, right, about what it accepts.
Right. And I like JSON schema. JSON API, on the other hand, I guess I should clarify. I prefer, it's difficult to say, but I think in most cases you can write a sane API without it being JSON API, you know, the actual branded JSON API.
Without having any specific opinion for or against JSON API, like, the idea is you should never have to care.
Right, except that you do. Like, I've worked on a couple projects now using JSON API, and it's never perfect, so you have to care. It's kind of like the idea of semantic versioning. You should never have to care what version you're using. You just, like, limit it to this, like, you specify what you're willing to tolerate, but that assumes a world where everybody's perfect and doesn't introduce breaking changes and minor point releases.
Right.
Right?
But just to play devil's advocate, that's not necessarily a problem with the spec. That's a problem with the abstractions that you're using or that exist.
Sure. It's a problem with humanity.
Sure.
And we're all human. So, like, sure. Put your pessimistic version constraints in place, but still run your test suite after you run bundle update, right?
Right.
And, you know, still have good tests that will catch those things for you or whatever. Like, I would never go from Rails 5.1.1 to even Rails 5.1.2 without giving the site a once over, right?
Well, sure. Like, I mean, Rails is also a special case because we will, especially if that's a security release,
right,
like, we'll just have straight up breaking changes in security releases.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
Does it though?
It makes sense to break compatibility for a security fix.
Right.
You would ideally, you'd be bumping to 6.0, 7.0, 8.0 when that happens, but if you're not going to, I mean I like semantic versioning, but I also kind of understand where Rails is coming from on this standpoint. Yeah. I think we've mentioned before they could just use a different, like, they could just call it Rails next, or not next, but, like, come up with some marketing name for the next version of Rails, right?
Right.
And then let the version number be independent of the marketable name of Rails.
Right, and that's what Android does.
Really? So, you know, the version number goes crazy between cupcake and ice cream and hot dog, or no, hot dog.
Right.
Hot dog's,
I mean,
not a dessert.
It'll either be a major or minor version bump.
Okay.
Never a patch. Although in reality, that number doesn't even matter. The only thing that matters is the API number, which is it's just an integer. And if there's any API changes of any kind, addition, breaking change, what have you, mm-hmm, they bump that number.
Yeah.
And so it could even be a patch release. If it was some sort of security fix or some, if there was some breaking change, no matter how minor, they bump that number. And then there's the semantic number, which is roughly semantic versioning. And then there's the user-facing version, which is, yeah, cupcake or lollipop, or I think marshmallow is the current one.
And you've also got, like, the Microsoft approach with Windows, right? Where, like, there was Windows 2000, which was Windows 5 under the covers. And then there was Windows XP, which was, like, the next major marketing version of Windows.
2000 was 4.
No, because 2000 was NT, wasn't it? And there wasn't NT 4. There wasn't NT 4.1.
XP was the first,
I think,
full
NT. I thought
OS.
Hang on.
You can
Windows NT 5.0 is Windows 2000. Windows NT 5.1 is Windows XP. Windows NT 5.2 just takes me to a table. I have no idea. It's something. It's also Windows XP.
Wait, is that implying that there were no breaking changes to
APIs? It's not semantically versioned. Who knows? I have no idea. And then you have, like, Windows developers did things where they were like, does it start with a 9? Then it's Windows 95 or 98. And they're like, actually, we kind of wanted to use Windows 9, but never mind. We'll just call it Windows 10.
I mean, the actual Microsoft versioning scheme, right, is that we're on Windows 1.80 because they just don't make breaking changes to anything ever.
Sure.
Like, you remember the whole SimCity story?
Yeah, right. Is SimCity running? Yes. And we did find the link for the I ended up putting it in the show notes retroactively. So if you heard that podcast and couldn't find the link in the show notes, there is a link. It's a Joel on Software link in that episode. You can go find it.
Did you read the blog that guy has that he links to in that article?
No.
The link is broken, but the name of the blog is still around, and you can just find it on its new location. It's literally just the same guy telling all kinds of stories about like why funky parts of the Windows API is that way, and you know, just stories of basically backwards compatibility, fun stories.
Right, and I'm sure it's all because like this major company called us up, or like we had a bunch of customers, and this major company wouldn't fix their bug, so. We fixed it for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's basically been it for Rails 5 upgrade pains for me. I was using hide action for some weird reason. Like when I include modules, I write like public methods on a module and then test those public methods. And then I use hide action so that when it gets included, it doesn't appear as a routable action.
Right.
So that's gone. Hide action is now gone. So
I just don't use controller action style writing.
Well, the alternative. Right. And the alternative, but I don't like when you call like controller.action methods and you get back a whole bunch of stuff that was included by modules. So in clearance, I'm very careful to say hide those actions, but I can't do that anymore. So now instead, on include, I mark all of those as private. So I can still test them, but now they're private. It's one of those things that's kind of a breaking change, right? If you happen to be taking advantage of the fact that those methods were public, like say in your test, a controller test saying like controller.signedIn query. Right. If you were doing that in a test, we give you helpers to do that. So like I viewed that as like you shouldn't have been using it that way. It's not a breaking change. It was a bug that I'm fixing. So we'll see when I release the next version of Rails, the next version of clearance, if anybody has any problems with that. But I don't think it'll be a problem. So that's what I opted for there. But other stuff like, I mean, I see hide action on apps a little bit. That'll have to go away. But I haven't come up with anything major just yet. So I think it'll be hopefully relatively smooth. There's going to be some dependency stuff probably. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's always what makes it painful, right?
But I mean, like, you know, your app's going to have some new dependencies. And some stuff's going to change, too. Like, particularly, I would assume because of the work that's been happening with Action Cable to adapterify it, and things like that. Like, in active job, the default queue changed from inline to async.
Right.
Or the default handler changed from inline to async.
Right.
Using concurrent Ruby in the background to run that asynchronously. So if in your tests you were doing something where you were like calling deliver later, but an integration test, you were just checking to see like, did this mail get delivered? That test is going to fail because now it's running async. Stuff like that is happening.
I wonder if, I think we might still have it be inline by default in tests.
That's not my experience.
I guess it's also right. The intended way of testing it is just testing whether or not a job was enqueued and not whether or not the job did its thing properly.
Right, but this is an integration test, right?
Right. I'm not saying that's how I would want to test it. I'm just saying that's presumably the logic.
I actually think it's a really good idea to just use something asynchronous in tests and development if you're going to use something asynchronous in production and staging or whatever, what have you. It just introduces a lot of testing complexity. Like, how do you test the result? Like, you can test that something got enqueued is basically the best you can do.
Right, well, or you await a result.
Right, and you can test that job separately as well, right? Executing it without enqueuing it in the job thing. And that's probably the best way to go. But again, for compatibility reasons, what I did in the test was just like, say, for these tests, there's a before filter that sets the adapter to inline. And then when we're done, we set it back to whatever it was. So that seems to work just fine.
Can't you also just do it in a setup block for the tests themselves?
Right, that's what it is. It's an around. To clarify, this is for the tests that get generated into people's apps.
Right.
So like one clearance has a generator that says, you know, generate me feature specs for the sign in feature. So then you can do whatever you need and you can always come back and run those sign in tests. Right. And in the like for password reset, we deliver an email. And if you have active job, we use deliver later.
So those tests can't be run concurrently now.
Sure, I guess. Is that something people do?
It's something that I think, well, CircleCI tries to do it, and I think it's something that I wish that more people probably wish they could do.
Sure, yeah. That's one of the major things coming for in Ecto 2.0 in Elixir land is the ability to run concurrent tests that depend on the database. I haven't played with it much, but it seems pretty cool. You going to be able to do that with Diesel?
Yeah, I mean, they already run concurrently by default.
Perfect.
I want to look more closely at what they're doing in Ecto because it sounds like it should be slower, but they added in Ecto 2.0 the ability to parallelize the actual query itself,
mm-hmm.
presumably by taking multiple. I remember asking one detail, and I know that they take multiple database connections out of the pool. in order to do it, but I don't know what they're actually doing.
Yeah, because that's also going to work for preloading as well, where you're going to be able to preload concurrently.
How would that work? Because you need the first query to finish to know what data you're preloading.
Right, but then if you're going to preload three other things, right, you can preload those three things concurrently.
Oh, sure. That, yes, right. Oh, that's probably all I'm thinking of. That would make more sense. Anyway.
All right. Yeah, so so far, I think the lesson is definitely try the betas because I'm finding, you know, little things here and there that I'm making notes of that I can, you know, it'll apply to the workshop that we're going to do at RailsConf. It's not why I'm doing these, but it certainly was, I guess, really nice to be able to just say, like, make some notes and look through these commits when it comes time to prepare that workshop, which we're doing now, and say, you know, these are things we want to look out for. These are the things we're looking for in a target app that we're going to try and upgrade to Rails 5. We want it to have these problems because they're interesting. And it'll certainly, trying to get started on it will help you prepare as well for your apps. Unfortunately, like, particularly, it's kind of hard with Bundler, or is it Ruby Gems?
Yes.
To test against all of the betas. To test against the beta, I guess, I mean, we say the beta, but it's really all of the betas. There's like beta for Active Record, beta for...
Oh, right.
If you're testing a library that depends only on Active Record and you want to test against Rails Master, can you do that?
Yeah.
How?
Gem Active Record, GitHub, Rails/Rails.
But that's depending on Rails.
No, that will look for the Active Record gem spec.
Okay.
Yeah, no, Ruby Gems is smart enough that if there is a folder with the same name as the gem to do that.
Okay, cool. So I'll try that then. But then you have to hunt down all of the things like RSpecs, at least as of a few weeks ago, RSpecs released versions don't support Rails 5. So
correct.
You've got a point to...
There is a released version that supports Rails 5.
Oh,
but there's a beta. I think that it might be a beta release, but that definitely happened at least 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Okay, so probably right around the time I was trying to add these. Because then I had to hunt down and I would just be like, okay, use RSpec mocks from master. Okay, use RSpec core from master. Use RSpec this from master. And because RSpec is a meta gem, right? You have to like add the master for all of those. And then you're going to run into the odd dependencies, which aren't something like RSpec or Rails, that they're sitting there, you know, maybe they were upgraded for 4.2, but who knows how long it will be till they're upgraded for 5.
Right.
And there's no, like, if you're the person who starts testing that, you can also potentially be the person to help fix any issues, which oftentimes are just going to be deprecations that you can help fix. And then when there's a real issue, you can either raise an issue or fix it in the code. So try the betas.
I wish more people would set it up so that their master branch can also be used with Rails Master. And then also I wish everybody who has a gem would just run their CI against Rails Master as an allowed failure.
Yeah, I mean, I had people raising clearance issues against Rails Master before there was a beta, and I just didn't know how to handle that. Because I was like, well, I don't know that this is going to ship like this. Do I want to chase these problems, or do I want to just wait and see how it shakes out?
I mean, typically... It's pretty obvious usually whether it's going to ship or not. Like, is it just some bug that cropped up on master, or is there a deprecation warning that people are encountering?
But how do I tell the difference, right? I'm not getting a deprecation warning. But it's not a deprecation warning, right? The test fails, and it tells me, like, the first one I think I got was that it said this middleware, like, I tried to insert after a particular middleware, and it was no longer there. And I was like, well, I can go and try and figure out why this middleware is no longer there. Or I can wait and see if this problem goes away.
I mean, well, so that's the thing.
And it turns out to
like
be a
that,
real problem.
I would wait a week or two.
Right.
And then if you still aren't sure, the easy way to figure out is open an issue.
Yeah, I always feel bad doing that. You guys are so busy. Or you all are so busy.
I mean, yes, but we're busy in order to help people.
I guess that's true.
Like, it's not like you're opening something frivolously for no reason. There is a legitimate change in behavior that may or may not have been intended. And worst case, we close it and say you were depending on an implementation detail or something like that. But if that's what the case, then you know, oh, I do need to actually fix this.
Right. In my case, it was something I actually had to fix. Like, what happened was the params parser, like there's an action dispatch params parser middleware, I think, and that went away. It just gets instantiated in line wherever it's possibly needed. It's no longer a middleware in the stack.
Right.
And there happened to be no good reason why we were trying, like that I could find that why we were trying to insert after it. Because inserting wherever just seems to work just fine as well. So,
I mean, maybe you were relying on params at some point?
Maybe at some point back in the day, perhaps. But all the tests pass on all the versions of Rails without it, so I'm not too worried about it. But yeah, like stuff like that. I love the idea of running against master, but in reality, it's going to have to run in my allowed failures group, right?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not advocating putting it in your main group. Definitely put it in allowed failures. Like, there will be times that there are just bugs in master as well.
Right.
There's a reason that we have these stable branches that are separate.
Right.
So if you support 4.2, you should definitely run against 4.2 stable in your non-allowed failures.
Well, I'd be tempted to do it in allowed failures as well. I guess. Well, I want to be notified, I guess, if it fails. And the only way to be notified is to put it in your regular test matrix, right?
Right.
Also, all of this assumes you're running something that can run a test matrix, which not every CI service, Circle CI, can do.
I mean, so, hey, if you've got a open source library and you're using CI that can't do a matrix.
Well, if it's open source, yes. But like, what about my app, right? It's just my app. And I want to run against...
No, I'm not recommending any of this for apps.
Oh, okay. You wouldn't recommend that people out there who have an app run against 4.2 stable?
If you want to, sure, you can. But no, I think it's much more important for gem authors to be doing it than app authors.
Okay. That also makes sense to me. Yes.
Because users have the expectation that when a new version of Rails ships... Or they don't have the expectation, but it'd be nice if they could have the expectation that when a new version of Rails ships... Like within days, everything in the ecosystem is just ready to go.
Right,
and that ideally should just be the delay of all of the various gem maintainers shipping the new version because they've just been keeping on top of master over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that also makes upgrades less painful.
Yeah. All right. I'm gonna keep you sold me. I'm gonna keep master. Well, again, I can only keep master in my allowed failures so long as the dependencies I need for running my tests.
Right.
Are also keeping up.
And so if everybody did this, it would work.
If the whole world did this all at once, it'll be really cool, guys.
But, I mean, hey, worst case, right? Okay, I've got a dependency that needs to get fixed. I'll open an issue on that dependency. Hopefully within a week or two that I'll get resolved. And until then, I'll just ignore it. And that's why it's an allowed failure. It's like,
all right. But then you got people like me who are like, I'm not going to chase Rails 5 right now. I'll do it in 6 months.
Sure. And there will always be people like that.
But. Yeah, jerks.
I mean, this is what we do in Diesel, for example. Nightly is in allowed failures. Rust nightly,
mm-hmm.
because we rely on unstable stuff. If you're running on nightly, otherwise you have to use a library called Syntex to make it work on stable for our code gen stuff. But we rely on unstable stuff for our code generation, and occasionally that'll break in nightly. And so what I'll do is usually it's about once a month now. There'll be a breaking change. And whenever I go and fix those, I have a separate thing in our main matrix that is nightly on a specific date. And that'll just be whatever the last date that I fixed it was.
That makes sense. Yeah. So you've sold me. I'll keep master in my allowed failures, I think, going forward. I do like a test suite that finishes really fast, but oh well.
Travis will report success before the allowed failures matrix finishes.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I also separately emailed Travis for support the other day because I was like, I know we're a bit of a unique case, but at ThoughtBot, we have commercial Travis CI. Like, we pay for Travis CI, and then we run our open source stuff on Travis CI because they have the test matrix. I would love to be able to say, on Fridays, use our paid-for TravisCI.com slots for our open source project so I don't have to sit there and wait for Travis to pass. Because it is the most, like, I can't just assume it's going to pass even when I run all of the tests locally, because it is like a clean room environment on Travis, which does catch occasionally things that I missed locally, even when I run my full appraisal suite, which appraisal is a thing that lets you run multiple gem files just like Travis kind of does. Even when that passes locally, sometimes Travis fails for good reason. And it's something they said to their credit. They were like, yeah, we're kind of looking into something. Like, even if I just had to click a button that said, like, move this project to TravisCI.com. And then I could move it back manually at the end of the day on Friday when I knew, like, okay, I'm done working. Let me move it back. I think that would be really cool to be able to do that.
Yeah.
If anybody from Travis is listening out there and wants to work on that feature and let us know, that'd be great.
It's actually interesting. One of the side effects of how Travis's whole slotting is set up is Diesel's test suite could be parallelized more than it is, but the suite will end up being slower if I actually parallelize it, just because we'll end up spending more time waiting for a new worker to be available.
Yeah, I did that in clearance for a while. The way I was doing it was I ran, like, each Travis slot was corresponded only to a Ruby version. And then I ran the test for all supported Rails versions on those slots. So I was only using a subset of the slots I'm using now, but it was harder to discover failures. I thought that maybe by going to more slots, I would get a faster test suite. In reality, it seems to be about the same because you'd have to wait for more slots, especially on the open source one. So I don't think it would be a problem. It probably would be significantly faster on TravisCI.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If Diesel could run on 12 workers, like, I could parallelize the damn thing and finish in a quarter of the time. Yeah. But and in theory, right, I wouldn't be using any more of their money.
Right, because you'd be whatever you trade off in systems or, you know, whatever they call them, you'd be offsetting that in time it takes to run the whole suite.
Right. And I'm assuming running three boxes for 1 minute is the same cost as running one box for 3 minutes.
Right. Who knows? I don't know. We don't know their economics. All right. I think that's good. Should we wrap up?
Yeah.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/55.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any other, you can tweet us at @_bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
Adios.
Ring, ring.